The whole nation of Israel, 4 to 6 million strong, had just started to move out from Mount Sinai at the end of Numbers 10. They had only gone 3 days' journey and had been listening to the morning and evening prayer of Moses as the ark was hoisted on the Levite shoulders who led the camp. Their morning prayer, "Rise up, O Lord, and let thine enemies be scattered, and let them that hate thee flee before thee." Their evening prayer was, "Return, O Lord, unto the many thousands of Israel," as the ark rested for the night. Everything seemed wonderful, and the excitement of the whole nation must have been sky high. They were finally moving and headed to their wonderful promised land. But as we open chapter 11, there are dark and ominous clouds which seem to descend upon the whole nation. It seems that the devil has been sitting back, watching the whole scene at Mount Sinai, observing this special nation begin their glorious march to the promised land. And when he discovered the plan, he rushed ahead to a strategic location on their planned journey and hid himself among the rocks in that barren land. When Israel arrived at that barren, bad land trap, the devil ambushed them in a trio of evil attacks. Each of these attacks centered around the sinful human nature in which we all are so prone to complain. Suddenly, these Israelites came down with a very severe case of grumbleitis. We find it coming out of the gate in chapter 11, verse 1. "And when the people complained, it displeased the Lord. And the Lord heard it, and his anger was kindled, and the fire of the Lord burned among them and consumed those who were in the farthest parts of the camp. And the people cried unto Moses, and when Moses prayed unto the Lord, the fire was quenched. And he called the name of that place Taberah, because the fire of the Lord burned among them." Just got three notes about this first complaint. It's complaint number 6. First of all, it's an uncertain complaint. We're calling this Firegate, by the way. Firegate. There is the uncertain complaint. The people complained, "I suppose it could have been anything. It's so hot and dry here. Or this manna hash is getting old. I'm so tired of this barren, rocky land. Are we almost there yet? The food needs salt. Obviously, Moses does not know where he's going. Why couldn't we wait until someone invented air-conditioned buses to make this trip?" Whatever their complaining was, it apparently spread rapidly, just as complaining usually does. It has been estimated that the average complaint travels 100 times faster than the fastest compliment. Think about that for a moment. So there's an uncertain complaint. There is then an unusual consequence. God didn't mess around with them very long. He said, "Man, I'm sick and tired of this." And he sent fire among them. I don't know whether he struck them in with lightning to start this fire or what. But there it comes, the fire. God was angry. He sent fire into the camp, which apparently killed many people. Then there's the unbelievable correction. Moses prayed, and God immediately quenched the fire. They left that place with a sigh of relief and a sign naming it Taberah, which means a burning. There are not too many names given to specific locations in a desert, but they would never forget this shocking event and its unusual location. They all remembered it. It's called Taberah. Which leads us to complaint number 7. Some of you are wondering where complaint number 5 and 4 and 3 and 2 and 1 are. I'll talk to you about that in a moment. Complaint number 7 in the meantime, lusting for the flesh. And I titled this one, "Where's the beef?" For those of you that have been around for several years, you've heard that commercial before, haven't you? "Where's the beef?" And that's really what they're saying. "Where's the meat?" The complaint particulars in verses 4 to 9, and it says in verse 4, "And the mixed multitude that was among them fell to lusting, and the children of Israel also wept again, and They said, who shall give us flesh to eat? Where's the beef? Where's the meat? Don't you feel sorry for those people? Now, the complaint particulars include, first of all, the first couple of words in that sentence, the mixed multitude. What is a mixed multitude? This time, the unsaved, faithless goats had infiltrated the flock and became the catalyst, creating an atmosphere of complaint. You got the sheep and the goats. The sheep are the real believers. The goats are the pretenders. They're not really saved. They're not God's people. They started the grumbling, and they soon infected the whole congregation. Grumbleitis again, strucks again. It's worse than the coronavirus. Here is, by the way, a classic illustration of why God forbids unequal yokes. He doesn't want us marrying unbelievers. He doesn't want us making contracts with unbelievers. He doesn't want us to make companies together with them. He doesn't want us to choose our unbelievers as our best friends. While it's not wrong for us to be friendly to all people, the purpose for our friendship should be very clear from the beginning. Our purpose is to let you know you need Christ as Savior. 2 Corinthians 6:14 says, be ye not unequally yoked together with unbelievers. For what part has an infidel with a believer? What concord has light with darkness? Paul warned us in 1 Corinthians 15:33, be not deceived. And when he says, be not deceived, that gives us an indication that many times people are deceived. And there have been many, many believers that have been deceived by this. Don't be deceived, he says. Evil company corrupts good morals. I mean, it's pretty obvious, folks. You don't ever put a good apple into a basket full of rotten apples and say, okay, good apple, go and fix the rest of those apples there. It doesn't happen that way. The good apple goes in there and it gets contaminated. And so it is with when we start mixing with unbelievers. Our goal should be to serve together and to grum together and make as our closest friends those that are Christians and walking with God. The mixed multitude is the one that had a great impact on this. Not only were there mixed multitude, they were also coveting. They were coveting. The last commandment of the ten says, thou shalt not covet. And you know what? There's many things that we can covet in this world. What they were coveting happened to be a form of food. Did you ever complain about your food? I mean, that is probably one of the most common things that we all complain about. Give me something that I want. I mean, children would have pizza and ice cream every night if you'd let them. And many times they complain about the peas or the beans or the whatever you put on their plate. And adults, we just get more sophisticated in our complaints. I mean, we complain about neighbors, we complain about coworkers, we complain about our in-laws, we complain about all kinds of things. What their issue was they lacked meat. They fell to lusting, the text says. Fell to lusting. That's what happens when we start coveting. We fall to lusting. And it's never good. When we fall, we usually break something. The deeply embedded tendency to lust can easily overwhelm the strongest believer. And when it is fed by a crowd who all cry for the same thing, it soon becomes like an essential, a great necessity. I gotta have that. Keep in mind, these people were not just tempted a little and toying with lust. It quickly mushroomed into a Category 6 hurricane. The picture here is of the whole congregation weeping, crying for food. They thought they would die without it. I mean, parents have told their children, if I eat this, it'll kill me. Yeah, it'll kill you, all right. And we sound sometimes like children. This was a terrible thing. It might be compared to our whole congregation all of a sudden becoming deprived of our cell phones for a couple of days. Now, can't you imagine the crying we'd all have if I said to you, nobody's, drop your cell phones off there on your way into the auditorium tonight, right? All right, some of you would be crying at least. I don't know. But so there's coveting here. The next thing is excessive nostalgia and grumbling. Excessive nostalgia. You hear? See what they're saying there? Verse 5, we remember the fish which we did eat in Egypt freely, the cucumbers, the melons, and the leeks, and the onions and the garlics. I'm saying, really, leeks? Is that really that great? How many of you like leeks? Man, you can have all. Anybody gives the leeks to me, I'll give them to you, I promise, all right? But they're one, oh, we got all this wonderful stuff in Egypt. But now, he says in verse 6, our soul is dried away. There is nothing at all besides this manna before our eyes. We're going to eat this stuffy looking manna. I come home sometimes and I say to my wife, all right, soup again? Sandwiches again? Beans again? Potatoes again? Oh, man. Every day, what's for lunch? Well, we're going to have manna burgers today, all right? Let's make manna mash tomorrow, all right? Let's come on. Can you figure out the many different ways they made manna? Now, I don't blame them a little bit for crying out, but you know what, folks? It just is all that way for all of us. We get something and we don't like it, and it's just that old coveting virus and that old lusting inside, and we start thinking about the past, and oh man, I can remember that wonderful pizza I had last week. Why can't we have something good? Then you hear somebody else and you pass somebody else and the smell comes wafting in you. I'm telling you what. We remember, then we covet. And we imagine when somebody begins to covet, listen carefully. When somebody begins to covet, when you begin to covet, they always imagine life was better and could be much better with their desired conditions. I can remember as a teenager, I saw somebody else riding his 10-speed bike. And I had this old 1-speed bike. And it had some rust on it and everything. And I just, you know what, I had to have a 10-speed bike. And I just knew when I got that 10-speed bike, life would be 1,000 times better. So I saved up my money for my paper route, and I saved and saved and saved until I could afford my own 10-speed bike. And I got my own 10-speed. I looked at all those pictures. I went to that store, and I knew exactly what I wanted. And I got that 10-speed bike. You know, it didn't have those big, ugly-looking handlebars that came up like this. It was the curly underneath ones. They were the real cool ones, like the ones that they do in the big races, though, you know, the Tour de France and so on. And so I tell you what, I had that fancy bike, man, and I had it all. In fact, I even got some special tape on it, and I got some lights on it, and I had the greatest bike in town. That's not saying much for Belfast, is it, Pastor Bob, all right? But I had one, and I'm telling you what, about 3 weeks into that, I kind of got tired because I had to reach way down here. And I think, man, I like those other ones. Or I'm, you know, I go anyplace fast. I mean, it was cool to have those different speeds, but I found out I usually just use about 2 or 3 of them. I didn't need 10 speeds. And, you know, I found out after a couple of months that life wasn't really any better just because I had that 10-speed bike. But, you know, all of us look at things sometimes and we have that coveting virus. We see, you know, the Joneses have it and the Smiths have it. You don't have it? You don't have it? Well, you want it. And you know, and whoever else has it, man, I've got to have that. And I just know when I have that, it's going to make life so much better. Excessive nostalgia. And imagining life is just going to be so much better if I get what I want. And then sometimes the Lord gives us what we want just to show you. Doesn't make life any better at all. In fact, many times it makes life more miserable. And you end up causing more troubles just by getting what you wanted. ungratefulness. Verse 7. And the manna was as coriander seed, and the color thereof was the color of a bdellium. And the people went out. Don't ask me what bdellium is. I don't know. You want to know what the color is? I don't know. All right? And I don't know that anybody does know. But if you think you do know, you know, educate me. And the people went about, verse 8, and gathered it, ground it in mills, and beat it in mortar, and baked it in pans, and made cakes of it. And the taste of it was like the taste of fresh oil. Now, don't think in terms of Pennzoil oil. This isn't WD-40 or whatever. All right? This is the oil that you get at olive oil at your restaurants sometimes, okay? So that could be good. And when the dew fell upon the camp at night, the manna fell. You know, God just keeps giving it to them, even though they're complaining. God is so good. He gives us our daily bread, even when we tend to be complainers. Just think about that, how God is and how ungrateful we are sometimes. You know what? You will either be grateful and thankful, or you will be ungrateful and a grumbler. You can't be both at the same time. Paul said it this way in 1 Thessalonians 5:18, in everything give thanks. For this is the will of God. You want to know what God's will is for us today? To be thankful. Don't just wait for Thanksgiving. Be grateful and thankful every day. All right, we need to keep going. I'm only started here. The commanders, please. I mean, this is a sad scene. Moses heard the people weep, verse 10, throughout the families, every man in the door of his tent, and the anger of the Lord was kindled greatly, and Moses was also displeased. So the people are whining and crying and angry, and Moses gets angry, and God gets angry. Everybody's angry here now. What a scene. It's like a household that's in uproar. And Moses comes, he says, Lord, I can't handle this anymore. Just kill me. I'm done with them. Just kill me. That's what he says. He says that in verse 15. And if thou deal thus with me, kill me, I pray thee, out of hand. It's a good thing God doesn't always answer every prayer request we make. You know what I mean? So he cries out, he complains. And there's compassionate provisions. God gives Moses 70 spirit leaders, spirit-filled leaders, to help care for the nation. But then at the end, God also gives them meat, and then he gives them some consequential punishment. He punishes them with a very great plague. And so we've got this where's the beef problem. Let's quickly move on to number 3, complaint number 8. Here we go. We've had 6, number 7. Here we come to number 8 now. And the question here is, who died and left you, boss? That's really what's being said here in chapter 12. And Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because of the Cushite woman whom he had married, for he had married a woman of Cush. And they said, hath the Lord indeed spoken only by Moses? Hath he not spoken also by us? And the Lord heard it. So there's a derogatory charge there. Miriam seemed to lead this rebellion here. Warren Wiersbe said, 3 pieces of evidence lead to the conclusion that Miriam was the leader in this family rebellion. First, she is mentioned in Numbers 12:5, and the verb spoke is feminine in form, and Miriam alone was disciplined by the Lord. So Aaron allowed himself, however, to get sucked into this. But Miriam apparently was the older of the siblings, and remember, Miriam and Aaron and Moses are all 2 brothers and a sister. And Miriam was the oldest. You remember Miriam's the one that hid Moses as a baby in the bulrushes? So she's the older sister. I don't know whether she was trying to play the elder card on her brother. You know, I'm older than you, so you got to listen to me. And even Aaron was older than Moses too. So both of them are saying, you know what? I don't know why he thinks he's so important. We're older than him. I don't know whether that's the card they were playing, but I can remember my kids, I was right in the middle of the family of 12 kids, and I can remember my older siblings sometimes saying that statement to me when I was trying to take charge. I said, well, who died and left you, boss? Who do you think you are? You're trying to run this family, and Moses was running the show, wasn't he? Was he doing it because he wanted to? Or was he doing it because God chose him? Nobody died, but God did appoint him to this business. So there's this derogatory charge. And the main issue was not about who Moses married. The real issue was in verse 2, hath the Lord spoken only by Moses? Hasn't he spoken by us also? In other words, Miriam wanted some more power, some more authority. She wanted some of the glory. Always watch out when somebody's trying to gain power in any place. And so it's a disloyalty issue. There's a rebellion against God's chosen leader. There's a mutiny going on, a power struggle. There's divine correction. God isn't going to have this. He heard it, by the way. Did you see that at the end of verse 2? God heard it. That's divine omniscience or omnipresence. God hears everything and God knows everything. Then there's a divine evaluation of Moses. Did you see that in verse 3? Now the man Moses was very meek above all men who were upon the face of the earth. Somebody says, if Moses wrote this book, maybe he wasn't as meek as he claims. Why would he write that about himself? Well, you know what? Moses didn't have the right not to correct, to write down what God told him to write. God says, that's what you're going to write? Moses said, okay, I don't like it, but I have to do it. The divine command. He says to Moses and Miriam, Aaron, I want all three of you to come together. We're going to have a powwow here. I'm going to talk to just the three of you for a moment. He pulls them away from the rest of the congregation. He's not going to embarrass them in front of them. And so he speaks and he says, listen, you need to understand something. And he talks about prophets. Here's a great statement about prophecy right here. And he said in verse 6, hear my now my words. If there be a prophet among you, I, the Lord, will make myself known unto him in a vision and will speak to him in a dream. That's two of the ways that God spoke to prophets. My servant Moses is not so, who is faithful in all mine house. With him I will speak mouth to mouth even plainly, and not in dark speeches, and in the similitude of the Lord shall he behold. Wherefore then, why were you not afraid to speak against my servant Moses? Did you know what you were doing? You were rebelling against my chosen vessel, and you were rebelling against me. God corrects them. He rebukes them. And he specifically directs it to Miriam and Aaron, which leads to the damning consequences. God is angry, and that's a very scary thing. You do not want God to be angry with you. Miriam is stricken by God in a severe case of leprosy, a dreaded, deadly disease. When God leaves, she is stuck there and white as a sheet, sick and ready to die, which leads to a desperate cry from Aaron. He suddenly realizes the big mistake he made, and he cries out, please, Moses, we can't let our sister die. And Moses agrees. He cries out and asks God to forgive her. There is a designated cure, though. God makes an interesting statement in verse 14. And the Lord said unto Moses, If her father had but spit in her face, should she not be ashamed 7 days? Let her be shut out from the camp 7 days, and again, that let her be received again. So Miriam was shut out for 7 days. You know what? God says, yeah, I'll heal her, but I want this to be a warning to her, to Aaron, and to everybody else in the camp. You don't complain and mess around with my servant. Moses is the man that I'm speaking through. You better listen to him. So, unfortunately, they didn't learn their lesson, as we'll see as we come on to the next one here. Let's quickly move on to number 4, the complaint number 10. Now, some of you are just saying, wait a minute, didn't we just do complaint number 8? And now we're skipping to complaint number 10? And the answer is yes. And you want to know why, right? Well, I'm not going to take time to tell you right now, but I checked them all out very carefully, and here's the sheet. And I'll leave it out there, and you can get a copy of it if you want to. Just maybe talk to somebody and get it. But there are 10 rebellions, and we'll see that in the next chapter. 10 rebellions. And I counted them up, and I don't know where they all are. One of them is missing. So apparently God didn't even count one of them. Or he didn't tell us what it was, or it happened there, and we just don't have record of it. Maybe it was in earlier. We don't know. But at any rate, there's complaint number 10. The rulers are chosen in chapter 13. And by the way, two of them are Caleb and Joshua. Those names are so well known in the history of the nation. And yet these other 10, you couldn't tell me one of them without reading them. You don't know their names because they were failures. And their names go down in infamy. But Joshua and Caleb, because of their faith, rose to the top. The commission received, go spy out the land. This is called Spygate here, by the way. And they go back and they do the spy, and they come back and they give a bad report. 10 of them do. They all say the land is wonderful, but 10 of them say, but we can't go in there. It's not going to work. God will, you know, we can't do it. They're giants, and they look at us and we're like grasshoppers to them. Just a little bit of exaggeration, but you know what? They're showing their faithlessness. Joshua and Caleb, they get up and they say, no, we can do this. We've got God on our side, which is what David said later, what Gideon said, what others said through the years. They know that God said, I will be with you and I will fight in your battles for you. The conflicting reports lead to the congregation rebellion in chapter 14. They wanted to stone Moses and Caleb and Joshua. Then God gets angry in chapter verses 20 to 38 in Numbers chapter 14. And he says, I'm done with you. Verse 20, the Lord said, verse 20 of chapter 14, and the Lord said, I have pardoned according to thy word, but as truly as I live, all the earth shall be filled with the glory of the Lord. That is a powerful statement, folks. And it probably has reflection on the coming millennial kingdom. All the earth is going to be filled with the glory of God. God intended it to start with the nation of Israel to go in the promised land. He wanted to bless them, and through them, he wanted to bless the entire world. But it never happened because of sin. And so we are looking forward to it because the rest of the Old Testament continues to prophesy. It's coming, it's coming, it's coming. There will be a wonderful kingdom someday in which the glory of the Lord will fill this planet. I look forward to that. I just can't wait for it to happen. Sometimes I daydream about it. But he goes on, he says in verse 22, because all these men who have seen my glory and my miracles, which I did in Egypt and in the wilderness, have put me to the test now these 10 times. There it is, 10 times, and have not hearkened to my voice. Surely they shall not see the land which I swore to give unto their fathers, neither shall any of them that provoke me see it. But my servant Caleb, and so on. And he goes on to say, you guys that didn't have the faith, you're not going in, and your carcasses will fall here in the wilderness. But, he says, your little ones that you thought would be prey, they're the ones that will go in and possess it. So then they try this contrary reaction. Finally, they realize, oh, we messed up. So now they say, let's go. Moses told these sayings to the children of Israel, and the people mourned greatly. They rose up the next morning. They went up to the top of the mountain saying, come on, here we are. Let's go. We're going to go. We're ready to go. We know that we sinned. Now we're ready to go. And Moses said, wherefore now do you transgress the commandment of the Lord, but it shall not prosper. Verse 42, go not up, for the Lord is not among you, and that ye be not smitten before your enemies. So they went up anyways, and they got smitten. Some of them died right there. So many times people find out and submit to the Lord after way too many times of denying him and not following him. And they get themselves in trouble. And finally, when they realize they've lost it, now they say, all right, let's try it. Too late. Too little, too late, as we say. And so Spygate turned into a horrible, horrible rebellion. And that is becoming that is the turning point for this whole nation. At that moment, we had come up to that point 20 days or 30 into this whole time frame in the book of Numbers. Now, from that point on, the rest of the book is going to crawl. 38 years more in the wilderness. And they're going to all die there. Well, that leads to some correction. Verse 15, chapter 15, we call that recalculating. There's extra laws, additional sacrifices, rules and laws. There's recipes and rules for foreigners. There's a distinction. Sins of ignorance versus sins of presumption. And he goes about that, and he talks about that. This is a pretty extensive and apparently designed to discourage anyone who might willfully engage in known sin with a confidence that they can get forgiveness after the act. That is classic. It's the classic buy now and what? Pay later. People often think about the consequences of their sin as they wrestle with temptation. I know it will cost me something, but I think I can afford it. It is their foolish rationalization. Listen, folks, when wrestling with temptation, we should keep the following truths in mind. I want to give you three real quickly. Number one, sin will always cost you more than you expected to pay. It will always cost you more than you expected to pay. Secondly, it will take you further than you wanted to go. And thirdly, it will keep you longer than you intended to stay. Oh, just this little thing, you know, won't cost much, just once. And it turns out to be a major accident. It takes you years to come back. So these extra laws are given there. It's a classic illustration that follows the very next text. Then we call this enforcing the law, verses 32 through 36. I want to read this because this is powerful. And while the children of Israel were in the wilderness, they found a man who gathered sticks upon the Sabbath day. And they found him gathering sticks, brought him to Moses and Aaron and unto all the congregation. And they put him in prison because it was not declared what should be done to him. And the Lord said unto Moses, the man shall be surely put to death. God said that. Put him to death. All the congregation shall stone him with stones outside the camp. And all the congregation brought him outside the camp and stoned him with stones. And he died as the Lord commanded Moses, dying for picking up sticks on the Lord's day. The poor fellow got caught picking up sticks on the Sabbath. How innocuous is that? Surely picking up sticks wasn't that serious of an offense, or so he thought. He knew the law, no work on Sabbath, but he had been too busy the night before. He had been helping his wife with a birthday party for their son, and they had stayed up late watching the latest Netflix movie. So naturally, they needed firewood to cook for dinner that day. I know what the rule is, but maybe I can slip out while everyone else is at the worship service and pick up just a few branches for cooking. Even if I get caught, what are they going to do? It's just a one-time offense. I'll never do it again. I won't let that happen again. Besides, there's others that are doing this too. Can you hear how we tend to rationalize these things sometimes? On and on. His foolish brain continues to rationalize his decision to break the law. It's not like I'm doing a full day's work. Come on. I'm only picking up a couple of sticks. It will only take me 2 minutes. But that 2 minutes cost him his life. That 2 minutes robbed his family of a husband, a father, a brother, a son. That 2 minutes was costly, way beyond what he ever imagined. And so are some of the foolish decisions we make when temptation grabs a hold of us. Enforcing the law, then envisioning the law. Notice what they do next. Make fringes in their garments with a cloud cord of blue or tassels and ribbons. We're absolutely positive what these are, except that there is something visible which would serve as a reminder of them that this is very important. Keep God's laws. Tie a ribbon around your finger. For what reason? To help you remember something. They were all to remember the commandments of the Lord and to do them. We still desperately need this today, folks. People put signs on their refrigerators, on their bathroom mirrors, on their doors, their cars. They hang items from their rearview mirrors. They put them around their necks, their wrists, their ankles. Do whatever it takes to remind you, yourself to read God's word and pray each day. Envisioning God's word, bring it to your mind. All right, number six, complain again. Chapter 16 and 17, Korah's rebellion. They barely get back on track when the enemy strikes again. This time the attack comes within a key leadership group. Distinct identity in chapter 16. Korah, the son of Izhar, the son of Kohath, and he took with him some men. And they rose up before Moses, chapter 2. 250 princes of the assembly, famous in the congregation, men of renown. These are the top guys in the nation, and they somehow sneak behind the back of the chosen leader, God's man, Moses. Dishonorable insubordination. They're saying the same thing that Miriam was saying. What makes Moses and Aaron, these guys, so important, so special? We can do the same thing they can do. There's a dividing issue in verses 4 through 15, and it's about this, who God has called. And then there's this distinguishing incense. God says, all right, you have them bring their incense. You bring your incense, we'll bring our incense, and we'll see which incense God accepts. Then from their incense, we have to God's being incensed. He is angered at them. And he says, get away from those guys. I'm going to strike them dead. You better get away so you don't get killed with them. I've said that in joking to some people before. When you take a drink of coffee, I say, wait a minute, don't drink from that until I get over here, because when God strikes you, I don't want to get hit too. Now, I tease about that, but you know what? You want to be careful not to be hanging around people when they're disobeying God. You can get in trouble with them too. And that's what God says at the end. He says, get away from this family and flee. I'm sure that some of them said, okay, we better do it because Moses is saying that. And so they start getting away, and all of a sudden the earthquake starts and the earth starts opening up, and then they fled for their lives. And the earth opened up, and it says, and swallowed Korah and his men, and they went down to the grave. That word for hell there in the King James literally means to Sheol, into the grave alive. The earth swallowed them up and closed upon them. What an amazing display of the power of God. Then there's a disgraceful divine instruction, disgraceful iniquity. The people come and say, look at what you did. You killed God's people. God says, you know what? I'm just sick and tired of these people complaining. They better listen to the man that I've chosen. And so he causes a major plague to come on them, and then they are judged harshly for that. Then the next chapter, chapter 17, Aaron's rod buds. God made this determinative imperative here. He says, all right, I want every man from the different 12 tribes to bring a rod and put it up before the Lord in the tabernacle. And so they lay their rods up, and Aaron puts your name, so they engraved their name probably on that rod. Aaron engraved his on there. And the next morning when they came in and looked, God had done a miracle in which he caused Aaron's rod to bud, to grow shoots apparently. And then it not only grew shoots, but also it flowered and it produced almonds. Now what an amazing miracle is that? All the other rods are just dead pieces of wood. Aaron's is alive and producing almonds. And what does that prove to everybody? That God is the one that chose them. Aaron's family and is to be the priesthood. And so that's why we've got that there. Let's quickly move on. Correction again. So they need to go back to school. That's what I call that. Special induction, sovereign inheritance. The Levites are not supposed to get any land. They're just to trust God, and he's to give it to them. Then there's a sacrificial illustration here. This is the red heifer illustration, chapter 19. Some of you have heard stories about the red heifer, that there's a new red heifer that's going to Israel, and therefore the tribulation is close. I have a whole page here a page and a half that answers that question for those of you that be interested. I'm not going to take the time to explain that. But basically, this is a sacrificial illustration that pictures the sacrifice of Christ. All the sacrifices picture in some way the sacrifice of Christ. And so just keep that in mind. It's another picture of coming of Christ. And then specific instructions on touching dead bodies. Then there's consequences in the next chapter. Chapter 20, we've got payday someday. First of all, it starts with Miriam's death. She dies and is buried there. And the text kind of makes it clear that it's because of her rebellion against Moses in chapter 12. God takes her out first. Perhaps this because she was the leader and is seen from God's judgment on her and not Aaron. But the next scene is about them pleading for water again and complaining. And there they are murmuring and complaining again. We need water. And Moses gets angry this time. And God says, speak to the rock. But Moses doesn't speak to the rock. He strikes the rock. And he doesn't just do it once. He strikes it twice. So what we have here is that he also disobeyed God. And we know that that is the reason why God did not allow him to go into the promised land later on. So there are consequences. Payday someday. Keep that in mind. None of us are perfect, and decisions we make someday will come back to haunt us. Be careful in what we do. Make sure we're doing the right things. Madness and serious rebellion and rejection. Edom stood against Israel. They wouldn't let them come in, and God gets angry with them. Mourning Aaron's death. In verses 23 through 29. So he dies, and it's obvious that he dies as a result also, again, for taking part in that rebellion against the leadership of Moses. Finally, we conclude with conflicts. There's struggle and discouragement. Verses 1 of chapter 21. We've got in the king Arad, the Canaanite who dwelt in the Negev, heard that Israel came by the way of the spies. Then he fought against Israel and took some of them prisoners. And Israel vowed a vow unto the Lord and said, if thou wilt indeed deliver this people into my hand, then I will utterly destroy their cities. And the Lord hearkened to their voice. Israel delivered up the Canaanites, and they utterly destroyed them and their cities. And he called the name of that place Horemah, which means destruction. But verse 4 is the key that I want you to see here. And they journeyed from Mount Hor by the way of the Red Sea to compass the land of Edom, and the soul of the people was much discouraged because of the way. It was a horrible wilderness, and it was hot and dry and dusty, and they had so much trouble. So they're struggling, and they're discouraged, which led to this serpents and death scene. You know this scene very well. The people complain, and they're speaking about Moses. Why'd you bring us up here to die? There's no water. It's terrible. All we got is bread. Now everything's coming out. They're complaining again. And this time God says, all right, he's thinking of here's another way to hurt him. So he sends in the snakes, the serpents, the vipers, the very deadly, poisonous snakes. And they begin biting the people, and people start dying. I don't like snakes. I don't like rattlers. I don't like black mambas, anything that's dangerous. I was out when we were out in Ghana with Rob and Penny. One evening we were going over to his pastor's house, and we were walking several blocks, and they said that the neighborhood said that they killed a snake in the area earlier that day. And so we got up on the road and we found that snake right on the road. I just said, you know, are you sure that baby's dead? They said, this is one of the most poisonous snakes in Ghana, and you better make sure it's dead. They said, it's dead. It was pretty flat, and the cars had been driving over it. And I was glad for that. But I thought, you know, the rest of that walk from to house, I'm walking very carefully. My eyes, I'm not looking at anybody else. I'm looking where I'm going and watching as best I could. I do not like poisonous snakes. But here they are being bitten to death. And the people cried. And so Moses goes, and they cry to Moses. They complain to him. So he complains to the Lord. And he cries out, and he says, all right. Make a bronze serpent and fasten it in the center of the camp. And whoever looks at it will be healed. That is one of the most amazing thoughts Just look, and it will save you. So Jordan Smith gets bit, and he goes into his tent, and he's dying, and people say, no, come on. Moses said, if you just look. Oh, what? If I look at a dumb piece of metal, that's going to save my life? Just, Moses said to do it, so do it. It's not going to hurt anything. I'm not, that is so crazy. And I wonder how many people died because they refused to look. And then I wonder how many that said their families brought them out on their beds and say, look. And they looked. And they were healed. And you know how this is a type, because it tells us in the book of John that as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, so the Son of Man must be lifted up, that whoever believes in him will have eternal life. So when we look to Jesus Christ, not only do we have forgiveness of sin, we get eternal life. And our sin, we've been bitten by the snake, the serpent, the devil. And we can be healed forever by looking to Christ. What an amazing picture that is. And so we've got that serpent and death. Then there's streams in the desert. Now they are starting to go and travel around in the darkest and the most difficult parts of this whole wilderness. And every place they go, they've got to have what? Water. 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 And so there's a lot of talks here about some streams. They're looking for streams anywhere they can get it, brooks and so on. At one point, they don't have any streams, so they're digging to try and create a well. And it notice what it says in verse 15, and at the stream of the brooks that goeth down to the dwelling of Ar and lieth upon the border of Moab. And from there they went to Beer, that is the well whereof the Lord spoke unto Moses, gather the people together and I will give them water. Get the people together and help cause them to ask me and I will give them water. Then Israel sang this song, spring up, O well, sing ye into it. And the princes digged the well, the nobles of the people digged it by the direction of the lawgiver with their staves. And from the wilderness they went to Matana. So here they've got, they're all gathering and they say, we got to have water. And Moses speaks to God and God says, tell them to speak to the well and have them dig. And as they dig, you speak and watch how God answers that prayer. So I'm convinced somebody came up with this song at that point. And they start singing, spring up, O well, sing ye unto it. And they made this song, spring up, O well. Spring up, O well, spring up, O well. And they all started singing together. And they're singing while the leaders are digging. They're digging and they're all gathered around. They're watching as they're digging. Spring up, spring up, spring up. And they're saying, now really, how long are we going to do this? And all of a sudden, the water starts coming. The water starts coming. And that was a song that they never forgot. They never forgot the miracle of God, of how he brought that water to them as they sang and prayed about it. Finally, we come to the last one, Sihon denial. Just like they went with Edom and Moab, this guy, they say, we want to come through your land. We need to get through. We're not going to stop there. We won't eat or drink any of your water. God always provides water for us, so we don't need that. We just want to get through. Nope, not coming through our land. God says, all right, take them out. And they did. They fought them. God gave them the victory. And then we have a couple of interesting things that happened from that. Jazer and Og, their names. God is already showing these people how strong he is and how he will give them total victory when they enter the promised land. But they have got to learn not to complain. They have got to learn to trust. They have got to have their faithlessness exposed. They've got to learn to fully trust him. And so do you and I. We need to learn to fully trust God in our lives. And we struggle with that because we're just like the Israelites. So let's make some applications as we conclude tonight. Number one, avoid pagan yokes. That's what caused their first time in their complaining. because they connected with the wrong crowd. Avoid pagan yokes. You young people, don't date unbelievers. Make that your rule of thumb. I will never date an unbeliever. Secondly, guard against coveting. We all naturally want things. And it's the most difficult thing for us, but we've got to listen to that commandment. Thou shalt not covet. We need to learn to be like the Apostle Paul. I have learned in whatever state I am therewith to be what? Content. Learn to be content with whatever God has given to you in your life. Contentment. And then finally, be grateful. Usually that's the thing that helps us to get over the coveting virus, when we learn to be grateful. Look around at all that God has given to you. Be grateful for what He has given to you and thank Him every day. You're either grateful or you're grumbling. You won't be both. When we're complaining, and we can always find something to complain about, we just all are born with that natural tendency to complain. We think it's an American right these days. God wants us to be thankful, be grateful. In fact, I would like to suggest you do something for me, and I've got a little picture to help you do it. I want you to check your grumble meter every day. Check your grumble meter every day. You ever seen a grumble meter before? There it is. You're pleasant, or you're irritated, or you're aggravated, or you're grumpy. And just do what Paul says in 1 Thessalonians 5:18. In everything, give thanks, for this is the will of God in Christ Jesus concerning you. And I was, you know, I just purposely ended up with that one because you're all grumbling already because Pastor went overtime tonight.